Good to see you all. Keep that passage open if you're at home and you don't have a Bible. Pause me. Go and grab a Bible. You'll find it helpful to have in front of you. But then do press play again because you'll want to hear what we've got to say. But look, it really is good to see you all. 1 Samuel 18, I was on a teenage summer camp in a place called Sedbo, which is a little bit up north. It was probably about 20 years ago. And I was helping as a student to sort of do practical chores. They're called task forces or assistant leaders. And you do practical things around helping the kitchen, clean toilets, do those sort of things to enable the camp leaders to be able to spend time with the members. And one of the leaders who was looking after me took me out for coffee and just asked me how I was going as a Christian. And I've had lots of those sort of conversations over the years. They've all been helpful, not all as memorable as this one. I remember being in this quaint little tea shop with a scone, and this chap, we were talking about evangelism, and we were talking about loads of different things through the Christian life. And then he said, "No, actually, this is the question I've got for you, Andy. It's one of the most piercing questions I've been asked." He said, "Do you love God?" Said, "Do you love God?" Now, I've been a Christian for quite a few years, and of course, I trusted Jesus, my Lord and Savior, and I was seeking to live for Him, but I just thought, how do you answer that? You know, I wasn't quite sure how to answer that. Did I love Him? I remember I used to live in Worcester, for those of you who don't know me, and we used to run an event called Blokes in the Barn. Which was a bunch of blokes in a barn. And we'd always have a talk and pizza and various antics. And one of my friends came to do this talk, this guy called Matt Pope. He came and spoke here a few years ago. And he's the sort of guy who's he's shorter than you think he is because he's such a big personality. And he said to everyone in his talk, he said, "One thing you've got to know about me is that I love Jesus. And if you think that makes me a wimp, let's go outside now, we'll have a scrap, and we'll see who's the real boss." Right? Matt is a kind of a man's man. And he meant it, though. He loved Jesus. What does it mean to love Jesus? What does it look like to love Jesus? You know, maybe you're brand new at church. Maybe you're brand new to Christian things and you think, "I don't know that much about Christianity." And I think what you need to understand, Christianity fundamentally is not a list of rules they are to follow. The heart of the Christian faith is the person of Jesus and how you relate to Him. And that changes everything about your life and it changes everything about eternity. And I admit, you know, you've come to church, you think, "Wow, you know, I've been changing nappies this morning," or "Do you realize the week I've had, and now the preacher is tasking me, do I love Jesus?" Now, let me just talk about that a little bit. You know, what does it mean to love something? I mean, I guess we use the word love in lots of ways, so let me tell you, I love Welsh rugby. I love it, and particularly the 70s brand of Welsh rugby. For those of you who remember those days, JPR Williams, Gerard Davis. Anyway, I'm not going to go on about it. But what do I love about it? It was the offloading. It was always beating the English. It was all of that. Do you know what? I also love my children. I love them. I love their energy. I love it when they obey me in particular. But I love their smiles. I love their laughter. I hope you realize those two loves are not the same thing. Okay? I love Welsh rugby far more than I love my kids. I'm kidding. I love chocolate more than I love my kids. No, I'm joking that as well. We get the difference by the way the language of love is used. And in the English language, it's just the word love, and we use it, and the context depends on how we understand it. In Hebrew, it was exactly the same. There was just one word for love. In Greek, there was four different words, which kind of talks about different aspects of love. And so let's have a look at 1 Samuel 18, because in this passage, a whole nation falls in love with this secretly anointed king, the one who's just beaten Goliath, and the rejected king still on the throne. And look at how David's stock is rising. Look at verse 16. All Israel and Judah loved David. And it's not just them. Look at verse 20. Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. Have a look at verse 28. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and his daughter Michal loved David. And have a look at verse 3. Jonathan, who is also Saul's son, look how he describes him. Verse 3. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Everyone in this passage loves David. They love him. Well, almost everyone, apart from Saul, will come back to him. He's his enemy. But why do they love him? What does it mean to love him? Why is he so irresistible? You see, this king, firstly, and this is the big thing, he's an irresistible king. Why? Well, he's a king who wins. He's a king who wins. He's a king who wins their freedom, and they love it. Last week, if you were here, you'll realize David was selected to represent the entire nation against an impossible enemy, a giant, who, quite frankly, no one fancied fighting. But David was brave enough to have a go. And in this shootout, it took one decisive shot. And the people can't hide their response. Have a look at verse 6 of chapter 18. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul, and they were singing and dancing and joyful songs and tambourines and lyres. They are lining the streets for kind of this open-top bus tour as they come back. And David's maybe probably isn't like got the head of Goliath going, look at me. I doubt he's got that. But they can't get over their joy. They're jumping in the streets. And look at what they sing in verse 7. Look at what they sing. Saul slain his thousands, he's slain his thousands, and David slain his tens of thousands. I mean, it's just weird, isn't it? Can you ever imagine a nation getting so caught up with the victory of some representatives or a team of representatives where they win a shootout or something, and their victory is the nation's victory? And people go out on the streets and they're singing and dancing and making up songs about them. Or when they fail collectively, they all get out the Kleenex and cry. I mean, this is not that weird, is it? We can kind of relate to this. You know, just cast your mind back to last summer, if you will. I'm sorry if this is just particularly painful. But you'll probably be embarrassed to admit it. But there was a point last summer where if you were English, you were saying this: I don't love football, but I love this team. And maybe you were saying, I don't love football, but I love this manager, Gareth Southgate. All the way up to the final against Italy last summer. Now, when you said it, it wasn't romantic love, was it? It wasn't romantic love, but you meant it. Because their victory was your victory. If you're English. And the Italian victory was your victory if you're Scottish. But when England won, it meant something. It meant something. You know, England were almost the best in Europe at kicking a bag of air around a green field. It's not that big a deal, is it? But David's victory, his victory meant something. It really meant something. You see, his victory meant life. Do you remember this from last week? Just have a look at chapter 17, verses 8 and 9. And this was the challenge that Goliath put out there. Choose a man. Chapter 17, verses 8 and 9. Choose a man and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. You see, it was all on the line for this nation with this young man. Defeat would have meant disaster for God's people, slavery and death. And yet out of the jaws of defeat, an impossible enemy, how sweet was the sound of the ultimate underdog winning. And do you know what? God's people loved him. They loved him. See, his victory doesn't just stop there. It doesn't just stop there. you know, we've seen it, bless her, with Emma Raducanu. She had this incredible victory at the US Open, and she's young, and she's under massive amounts of pressure now to do really well. Huge amounts of pressure, poor girl. But here is David, he has this massive victory and all the pressure's on him. And how does he do next time? Verse 13, have a look at it. Verse 13, Saul sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men. And David led the troops in their campaigns. Now just stop for a moment and think about it, okay? So here is David, and he's a young man. Right, he really is a young man. Now, I was chatting to a friend of mine who's in the British Army, and he's doing quite well. He's in command of quite a lot of people at the moment. But he was telling me, how do you get there? How do you get to a point of commanding lots of people? Well, 2 years at Sandhurst, and then, here we go, let me get this right. After that, you become a lieutenant with a platoon of 30 men. You've got 30 men to look after. After that, after about 10 years, you become a major, where you have a company of 150 men. And if you're doing really well, then maybe when you hit about 40 years old, you become a lieutenant colonel. And that is when you have 600 to 1,000 fighters to be able to look after and run. Now, we don't know how old David is, but let's assume he's 23. And I think that might be older than he actually is. He has just been given the responsibility of someone 20 years older than him in the British Army. I don't know what it was for them. How would you feel about that if you'd been in the army for years and years and years, slogging your guts out, writing the essays, organizing smaller and smaller and bigger groups, and this little pipsqueak turns up and Saul gives him 1,000 men to look after? How do you think they're going to respond? Have a look at verse 5. Have a look at verse 5. Whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. Not just the people he's leading. The people who would have been the superiors, they look on and go, David is a different class. He's amazing. He's leading them. Verse 16, look at this. And how do all of God's people respond? Verse 16, all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. And he's just been successful. And they'd been floundering against their enemies who are coming in and killing their people and taking their land. And all of a sudden, they are being the people they're meant to be. See, why do God's people love David at this point? Because he defeats the enemies that none of them can defeat. And see, what we are seeing here is God is teaching us that is what the Lord's anointed king is meant to do. He's meant to win the victories that we could never win, and we love him for it. And so it shouldn't surprise us that 1,000 years after these events in 1 Samuel, as a man goes on a donkey into Jerusalem, they line the streets and they sing his praises and they shout, Hosanna! Hosanna! Hosanna in the highest! Here is the king who can save us. Why do they say that? Because they've seen and heard him. He's the king who can forgive him of sin. He's the king who empties the hospital and deals with suffering. He's the king who can deal with the enemy of the devil. And then he comes and wins the most surprising victory ever through his death and resurrection. You see, Jesus defeats the enemies we cannot defeat. Doesn't that make you want to love him? Doesn't that make you love him? See, he's a winner. But he's also humble with it. You see, he humbly serves. And I don't want you to notice in our reading, but Saul is sneaky, and we're going to come back to Saul in a moment, but he's constantly trying to get David under his control. And he works out, if the Philistines aren't going to kill David, then maybe one of my girls can ensnare and enslave him. And maybe that's something I need to think about my daughters and their potential when they grow up. I'm kidding. I'm not going to get them to try. That wasn't in my notes, and I regret saying that. So, Grace, you're not going to watch this, so that's fine. But I haven't got plans. I haven't got sinister plans for my girls. But Saul, look at the dad he is. He doesn't want to do what's best for his girls. He wants to use his girls to try and have control over David. And so he's going to offer him Merab, one of his girls. And verse 18, how does King David respond? He says, "Who am I? What is my family or my clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" Have a look at verse 23. Again, he tries with another girl this time, because he ends up marrying off Merab to someone else. Saul's up to games. But he says, what about my other daughter, Michal? And listen to what David says in verse 23. It's humility. "Do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known." He's not there going, "Yeah, of course you should ask me to be your son-in-law. You're lucky to have me, Saul. Do you realize how great I am?" No, he's humble, and he's not putting it on. He's absolutely not putting it on. I mean, can you imagine how you would cope, right, if you had all of Norwich coming out on the streets to sing your praise? Do you think that would go to your head? Would you think, wait a minute, there's quite a lot of people here who think I'm kind of special. I'm doing pretty well. See, David would only have had to have opened his eyes to realize all the nation were with him. And yet, it doesn't go to his head. He's genuinely humble. There's nothing false about this. He just is trying to serve. And I wonder what leader that reminds you of. And do you know what? The leader it reminds me of this week has been the Queen. I know it's not the answer you're expecting. But actually, it's reminded me of the Queen. You know, we've had a week where we've had leaders, and the integrity of leaders have been highlighted again, and it's been questioned. And she's been hired as someone who has just faithfully served and served. She should have retired by, do you know what I mean? By that point, we all would have retired, and we would have been enjoying our retirement. She's still going. You know, there's a humility and a faithfulness to a service, even when her kids are going bananas. And let's face it, in 1 Samuel, you tend to have a brilliant leader followed by their kids who are a disaster. But as a nation, we look on at the Queen, and I think on the whole, we find her leadership compelling. We're thrilled to have her as a leader. She doesn't have ego. See, we love this sort of leadership. And in 1 Samuel 18, you've got King Saul, and he's just about using his position and power to serve himself. We were told in 1 Samuel 8, he'll take and take and take. He's going to take your kids. And what does he do in verse 2 of chapter 18? "From that day on, Saul kept David. He took him. He did not let him return home to his family. He did what he will do. And yet, the king that God chooses uses his position not to push his selfish agenda, but to serve others." And why does David so humble in his service? Have a look at verse 12. Have a look at verse 12. "Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David." Verse 14. Have a look at it. What are we told about David? "In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him." Verse 28. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David. You see, David did do astonishing things, but why did it not go to his head? Because he knew it was just because the Lord was with him. It was because of the Lord's grace, because of the Lord's goodness. It was nothing to do with him. That is how he stayed so humble. You see, when people get to know David, this king, they love him. They can't but love him. And let's face it, who does that remind you of? Who does that really remind you of? His greatest, greatest, greatest grandson, Jesus. The one in whom Mark 10, 44 and 45 says this, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many, the one who would give him his very self so that we could be rescued from the judgment and the sin and the suffering we deserve. I wonder, do you know this Jesus? See, the more you get to know him, the more we should love him. And maybe you just feel at the moment, you know, my love levels for Christ are low. Things have gone to a low ebb. I've been a Christian for many years, and you don't realize the suffering I'm going through. And Jesus, why are you allowing this? And maybe that's you at the moment. And to that, I want to say, just pray to him and say, Lord, help me to see afresh just why you're so lovable. There are two big responses in 1 Samuel 18. There's two big responses. Obviously, everyone seems to be loving David, but there's two main responses, really. How are we to respond to this? And there is a father and son. There is Saul, and there is David. Saul and David. And how does Saul respond to David? I don't really notice this. But it keeps on coming up. And my wife, after the first sermon, I'm sorry, I talked about this last week. She said, oh, Andy, it comes up loads more than you said. But how does Saul respond to him? Have a look. Let's have a look. Verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. Verse 14. Verse 15. When Saul saw how successful he was, he was afraid of him. Have a look at verse 28 29. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and his daughter Michal loved David, he was still more afraid of him. He remained his enemies for the rest of the day. See, as Saul comes to terms with who Jesus is, he gets more and more fearful of him. Now, look, I just want to make a side point here, and this really hasn't got lots to do with text, but it's just worth saying sometimes in life, maybe you're in the workplace, and there's someone in the workplace who really doesn't like you. Don't assume. They may give you a really hard time. Don't assume it's because you're doing a bad job. It may be that you're doing a really good job, and they just feel threatened by you, and they feel threatened by your presence, think your presence threatens their job, or it may be a position in the family. Often it may be not your problem, it's their problem. And here is Saul, and he really is afraid of him because he's taken the nation away from Saul. And so what does Saul do? He tries to throw the spear at him a couple of times, and then he throws his daughters at him, and then he throws him to the Philistines, setting him an impossible challenge, which we're not going to go into the details of. I know you're all thinking, well, come on, Andy, talk about that bit. I can talk to you about it later. Awful, isn't it? It's an awful bit. It doesn't bear thinking about it. But David was committed, wasn't he? He was all in, and Saul was really committed to having David kind of do something which would most likely get him killed. That's the point. But David can't be controlled by Saul. And actually, Saul shows that he is powerless. And how is he powerless? Because ultimately he fears the people more than he fears God, and the people love David. You know, you see it in the religious leaders in the New Testament, don't you? You know, they want to kill Jesus, but they're afraid of what the people will think because the people love Jesus. That's what we're seeing with Saul here. He hates the king because he threatens his position, his power, his future. And I just want to say, look, maybe you're new to Christian things, and maybe you know people who are new to Christian things. And sometimes as people get to know Jesus closer and closer and closer, they realize that he really is the Lord, that he really is king. And actually, they find that uncomfortable, and they find that a threat because they don't want to give up their life to him. It will cost them something to follow him. maybe power and influence. What will people think of me if I start following Jesus? Maybe approval. What will happen with my family? And for some people to follow Christ, it's a threat because you just think, my family, how are they going to cope with this? And particularly if you're from another faith, it can be very, very costly to follow Jesus. Maybe it's comfort. You know, my life is not going to be about me anymore. And here is Saul, and he sees who Jesus really is, and he sees who the king really is, and he is a threat, and he just wants to get rid of him. See, that is Saul. But look at the final response, and it is Jonathan. How does Jonathan respond to Jesus? It's remarkable. Respond to David. I keep getting mixed them up. You can do the processing in your head. Have a look at verse 1. David finished talking with Saul. Jonathan became one in spirit with David. He loved him as himself. Verse 3, and Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan took off his robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Here is Jonathan. He becomes one in spirit with David. And he gives them these garments in what is described as a covenant commitment. And look, I just want to say, some people come to this and they say, look, it's gay marriage. Gay marriage is in the Bible. And what I want to say to that, I mean, I'm just going to look briefly into this because it's just helpful to know. See, the problem with that is we are reading into the text through our own 21st century white Western liberal glasses. We're reading that back into the text. But what we've got to understand is what is going on in the culture there. What's going on in the culture there? You know, we all get there is differences between cultures. So if you were going to greet someone in Japan, how would you greet them? Do you know what you'd do? You'd bow. Because whether it's COVID or not, they really need social distancing. Okay, that's how they greet each other. In the UK, how would we greet each other? With a firm handshake, or maybe now we're a bit scared by that. It might be a fist pump. I've spent some time in Uganda. And do you know how people greet people in Uganda? They take your hand for a handshake, and they don't let it go for a very long time. And as a Brit, as a Welshman, I find it a bit uncomfortable. And they even start playing with your hand. And you could read into that and think, that's a little bit odd, but it's not, it's culturally warm. It's just, it's a genuine greeting. It's like, I'm really pleased that you are here. What's going on culturally here? What's going on this moment, 3,000 years ago? Who is Jonathan? Who is Jonathan? He is Saul's eldest son. And what is Jonathan's next job? He's the king. He's the king. And actually, ironically, in a book where often the parents are great and the children are a disaster, here, Saul's a disaster, but Jonathan is great. See, here is Jonathan. He is the rightful heir to the throne. And yet, as he sees David, he knows. He knows he is the anointed king. And so what does he give him in verse 4? As he gives him his robe, what robe is it? It's his royal robe. As he gives him his sword and his bow and his belt, which sword and bow and belt? It's his royal sword and bow and belt. You see, here is Jonathan saying, David, the throne is yours. Now that's costing him, isn't it? His future was there. And he's saying, David, no, this is your future. You're the Lord's anointed. I'm submitting myself to you and your leadership. He's willing to do it even though it is personally costly to him. Because he knows that to submit under God's anointed king is to find the place of security and safety. It's the only place for flourishing in this life and for all eternity. And do you know what? When you become a Christian, that is what every single one of us do. We say to Jesus, the anointed king, I'm not going to carry on putting myself at the center. Jesus, all my life is yours. Even the bits which are going to be uncomfortable, even the bits that I think, Lord, I don't want to change there, but your word says this. You say, Jesus, it is yours. And do you know what? Following this king is a joy. Yes, there is pain in it, but it is a joy because you only have to live long enough to realize, to be king of my own life, I'm not a great savior. You know, to be king of my own life, there's all these things you put your hope and trust in. And let's face it, our career, our gifting, our football team, they always let you down at some point, don't they? They can never deal with our ultimate enemies, but not this king. Not this king. He is irresistible. He wins. He beats our greatest enemies. He's humble, and he is worth giving everything up for. And I wonder, if I'm so brave, let me ask you a question this morning. Do you love him? Do you love him? Let's bow our heads.